Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. Sunday the 18th of Feb. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And we're coming live from beautiful Namibia. Namibia, Kev, country of vast deserts, striking landscapes, rich cultural heritage, offers a plethora of fascinating facts. You know, I'll give you a few now. You might not know some of these. Oldest desert in the world. Namibia is home to the Namib Desert, considered the oldest desert in the world, with an age of at least 55 million years. The Namib Desert is renowned for its high red sand dunes, which are among the tallest in the world. You've also got the Skeleton Coast. We've seen and we'll be visiting, so keep your eye out for some pictures on X for that. Largest population of free roaming cheetahs. We'll hopefully get a chance to see one, and again, feedback on that this week.
Hopefully it doesn't feedback on us.
I like that. Rich in diamonds as well. One of the world's largest producers of gem quality diamonds. And the country's offshore diamond mining operations are among the most extensive globally, with diamonds being mined from the ocean floor off the coast. German influence, obviously, we've seen quite a lot of that. And we have these German colonial buildings from 1884 to 1915. So obviously there are many German restaurants, and even the name Windhoek and the coastal town of Swakopmund. What do you make of it so far? What are your first impressions?
It's like a smaller, quieter version of parts of South Africa, but yeah, not many people about. It's like a rural place, basically. I think the whole country is like this. You know, there's only 2.something million people in the whole place, and I think it's several times the size of the United Kingdom. So yeah, it's going to be interesting times as we go and visit the different things that we're going to go and visit. Yeah.
The world's second least densely populated country after Mongolia, which is not surprising considering the size of Mongolia. But yeah. One thing that struck me is first thing leaving the airport is just how good the roads are, and there's no one else on them, is there?
Yeah, they were pretty good. And I think it's pretty easy to build a straight road anyway when you've just got desert in front of you, isn't it? So hopefully we'll experience that over the next few days as we go to Hopengarup, which is Bazant's project, and
Ongombo as well, his African pioneers.
Yeah, which is close to Windhoek here, but we're going to do that later in the week, I think. We saw some mines as we were coming from the airport as well, you know, names that would resonate with people, I think, if they know this type of stuff. But I can't pronounce them. So,
Ojahasi mine, which is the one that was, I think, is defunct from 2015 onwards, but the plan is to get them back into operation, and the license is done. I think they've got the big processing facility up there, so hopefully some of these projects can move the ore to that for a processing facility, and then utilize that infrastructure that's already there. So yeah, it's a very exciting trip. I'm looking forward to it. So let's have a look at some of the news stories dominated this week, Kev. The UK economy entered a recession at the end of last year due to the reduced consumer spending, strikes by doctors, and a decrease in school attendance, with the economy shrinking by 0.3% between October and December, following a contraction between July and September. This marks the first recession since the pandemic, raising questions about Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's economic growth pledge. Despite a slight 0.1% growth in 2023, the economy's performance is the weakest since 2009, excluding the pandemic years. The government and opposition have different views on managing the economy, with the Chancellor considering spending cuts for upcoming tax reductions. Amidst economic challenges, officials emphasise the UK's resilience, low unemployment, and rising real wages as signs of potential recovery. So what do you make of that shock headline?
Well, I think it's not inevitable, but it was very likely, wasn't it, that it was going to happen. And I think it'll be short-lived as well, to be honest. I don't envisage that, we're going to have a recession throughout this year anyway. I'd be surprised if we haven't got growth in the first quarter of 2024, and then pretty much we're out of recession straight away, I think. So I don't think it'll be a long-term thing. It's a very, very slight dip of a recession. And yeah, people are going to make of it what they will for political gain, but I think the economy,
the oncoming budget, is going to be the last chance lean for Conservatives to sort of rein in the votes with potential tax cuts.
I think there are going to be some tax cuts, but I think they've got no chance. I mean, after the by-election this week as well, they got absolutely slapped, didn't they, again in the by-election. So I think everybody wants a change, don't they? And then they'll have the change, and Labour will come in, make a mess of it again, and then we'll go back to conservative again.
Yeah.
It's the same old story, isn't it? It's like,
well, let's go,
you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's go over the pond and have a look at how crazy things are moving over there with Trump facing a potential $370 million fine, raising questions about his payment capabilities, but also the fact that, did you hear his comments he made about NATO this week?
Yeah, I heard them, but totally taken out of context. I mean, he's an idiot for saying it, you know, totally taken out of context. And the media that is there to get him. And he doesn't seem to learn it's best not to say these things because it doesn't help anybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the legacy
gonna
media.
How is he going to pay his bills, though? $370 million fine, net worth of potentially $2 billion. Is he going to sell down some assets?
Well, I think when push comes to shove, he won't end up having to pay that much money because that's not the way these things work in the US. He will probably go for appeal, it'll be reduced, or ultimately some sort of payment schedule will be worked out over 10, 20 years. So I don't think it'll affect him too much at all, to be honest, even if he does pay it.
Yeah, he's got that $83.3 million defamation case as well, which he needs to settle. It's all coming out now, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, I think they are, as in the Democrats and the system itself, desperate for him not to become the president again. Because if he does, then they're all going to get absolutely smashed because he's not going to hesitate but to get rid of them. So it's interesting times. Who knows? I mean, you know, rock and hard place. Who do you want to be, President Trump or Biden?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it, really?
Well,
is it better the devil, you know, or is it some of the things that Trump is saying he wants to do is a bit worrying, really?
Yeah, but no more worrying than the things Biden's already done. I mean, the interesting thing is that all the rhetoric about the wall and we will not build a wall and we will not do this and all the rest of it, he's carried on and built the wall.
Mm.
So, you know, all those times he's slagging Trump off saying, don't do this, you know, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do that. And now he's carried on with that. And I mean, his methods over what happened in Afghanistan, his methods over what's happened in Ukraine and Russia. I mean, I don't know whether you have you listened to the Tucker Carlson interview with Putin?
Yeah, I listened to about an hour and 20 minutes. It took me 40 minutes to just try and understand what his history lesson at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, but it was good. Yeah. I thought it was good, and it was good democracy to listen to what he's got to say.
There's two sides to every story, isn't there?
Exactly. It's quite obvious, and I'm no Russian sympathizer, but it's quite obvious that NATO have been pushing and pushing and pushing Russia throughout the last two decades. Since the end of the Cold War, if you like. And he's been saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And they carried on. And, you know, by all accounts in 2014, that was a coup instigated by the Americans to put Zelensky in power. So, you know, if all of these theories are to be believed, holy moly, who do you trust? Do you trust the Russians or do you trust the Americans or you just don't trust any of them? I don't know. It's crazy.
Okay, should we move on to our guest this week?
Yeah, talking about power struggles, which is what we are talking about. Let's introduce our guest.
So let's move on to our special guest this week. Pleased to be joined by Sean Wade, CEO, and Jack Dan, geologist at Power Metal Resources. Welcome, gents.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so you had some significant news regarding the expansion of uranium exploration efforts in the Athabasca Basin, Saskatchewan, Canada, the acquisition of the Richards Lake uranium property. You highlighted the competitive nature of property acquisition in the area and commended the technical team's effective management of the staking process. The newly staked Richards Lake property spans 3,109.2 hectares and is strategically located among other uranium-focused companies. This addition brings Power Metal's total Athabasca uranium portfolio to 18 properties, covering over 1,043 square kilometers. Sounds like a great addition to the ever-expanding portfolio, Sean.
Yes, it is. It is, Phil. And thanks for that intro. That's, you know, that's very, very accurate. You know, it's, we are now, I think, in a position where we've got, I would say, you know, a very enviable footprint. You know, I think most of your listeners who follow uranium will know that the Athabasca Basin is, you know, the global center. You know, it's the number one address for uranium mining and exploration. It's now pretty much fully staked out. I mean, Jack will come on to explain exactly how we got hold of this property, and I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, this was a skillful job by the technical team, because, you know, this is difficult stuff to do, and particularly to get it so cheaply as well. So we've now got 18 properties in all in and around the basin, and that's a footprint of well over 1,000 square kilometres. So broken up into 18 different licence areas, some of which are going to go into uranium energy exploration, UEE, they spread out, which we can obviously going to talk about. But overall, there is we now have a major position in what is, I think, well, certainly one of the only commodities that is experiencing a genuine bull market at the moment. I mean, this was something that my predecessor, Paul Johnson, put in place, and he had the foresight to be starting this process with Oliver Friesen, who's our exploration manager and also runs Golden Metal, and obviously Jack as well. They had the foresight to be doing this when uranium was at $30 a pound and nobody cared. And uranium is now over $100 a pound and everybody cares. And so there is a great opportunity for us to add a lot of value for Power Metal shareholders here. So there's two ways we're going to look to do that. One is to do the uranium energy exploration spin out. And the other is also to look at the remainder, the bulk of the assets, and put together, you know, an aggressive exploration program for the coming year, and to start, or rather build on the work that Jack and the team have done there already, and identify high quality drill targets, and essentially do what we do as a business, which is to take early stage assets where we can stake them cheaply or get hold of them cheaply, add value through geochemical sampling, geophysical, airborne magnetics, early stage drilling. Jack will talk about the actual methods we use there, but we can show that we can add substantial value to those assets, such that now we're getting a lot of incoming interest from third parties to say, look, are there ways we could maybe work together to either explore or monetize in some way? So, you know, I'm keen to get across to shareholders that doing long-term and expensive exploration program, you know, is ultimately what will deliver the value for these assets, but that's not necessarily the only way that the value can be added. In other words, you know, people want these projects and they want to see some progress on them, and that's what we're doing. We're making progress on the projects, and you know, we're looking to monetize that over time. So yeah, this is a really nice announcement. It shows, you know, a further enhancement of the footprint already, and it gets us up to a really, as I say, enviable footprint overall.
Thanks for that. So Jack, yeah, just talk us through that sort of staking process, and also how you identify and bring on new kind of portfolios or properties into that portfolio of Power Metals.
Yeah, certainly. So all of the licenses have a minimum spend commitment that each company has to meet. If they fail to meet that on an annual basis, the license then gets recycled back into like a free pot. And on a certain day, certain time, all those licenses are released for companies all around the world, principally in Saskatchewan, to bid for and acquire. We are becoming increasingly skilled at actually acquiring these licenses during that small lottery period, but we're in competition with pretty much every other company in the area. So before these licenses become available, I review the potential areas, get an idea of what I like the look of, what I don't like, and provide that and circulate that around the technical team so we can be directed to acquire our licenses that fit our brief, fit what we want to do, and fit how we can deliver shareholder value.
Yeah, and you find it, as Sean alluded to there, with the value, the price of uranium going up, busting through that $100 mark per pound, are you finding it harder to get licenses and people are holding on to those areas, you know, more?
So not so much in terms of licenses becoming available. The rate seems to be fairly sort of consistent amongst the whole time. The issue is that we're getting lots of competition. So when we started doing this, we'd have maybe two or three other companies looking alongside us, and now we're looking at 10 or 20 other operators. So it becomes a challenge to, you know, really decide what is going to fit one in our portfolio and how we can target it and get it and begin to work.
So it sounds a bit like, you know, you've got the torches out at dawn and it goes to 12:01 and now the license is available. So you have 40 people all about to smack a big wooden stake in the ground. Is this how it works, or am I being a bit...
It's slightly more modern than that. There's an online service that the Saskatchewan government operates. So you all stand there waiting for the website to refresh. You press the, you know, the refresh button and then zoom into where you want to let what area you're interested in. Click validate and hopefully you get it.
Sounds like the annual scramble for Glastonbury tickets.
It is, yeah. It's basically Glastonbury, but for bits of land in northern Saskatchewan.
Very good. Jack, just give us an idea. Why has the uranium price gone from $30 a pound to $100 a pound? What is the geopolitical situation and also the ability for uranium to be available in the market for such an increase?
It's multifaceted, really. So we've obviously got the conflict in the Ukraine. That's severely limited or potentially will severely limit uranium that can come from Russia. which is a major producer and a major store of uranium historically. We're also building many, many reactors as a global population, something around the range of 400 are proposed around the construction. They're all going to need uranium. We've also had that for many years, there's not, you know, when uranium's at $30 a pound, why bother building your mine? Why bother looking? So we've got to a point where you need this commodity, and as happens so often in these cycles, everyone's scrambling for it, but we haven't got the output coming through. As a secondary note, it's difficult to find, it's difficult to mine, but when you do get it, it's very valuable. So that value chain takes a long time to develop. So we're just sitting on a pent up, like a spring of demand that hopefully will continue to rise over 2024.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting question, actually. And it's something just I think I would add is if you look at previous uranium cycles, I mean, one of the things with uranium is, you know, it's, I mean, in sense of nuclear power generation, I mean, obviously it's, you know, only a few decades old, you know, it's unlike a lot of other commodities. So we haven't seen that many cycles, and they have tended to turn on events. You know, we think of Fukushima, for example, pushing the price down. And obviously there's things like the Cigar Lake closure, which, you know, push it up. But one of the things that's present in this cycle that's not been in the past is the presence of sort of financial buyers of uranium. So you think of Yellowcake, which has been such a tremendous success as a stock, for, you know, for investors, and obviously is doing extremely well at the moment. You know, that was a fantastic idea that those guys had, you know, to, they saw the cycle coming. You know, they buy physical uranium and they hold it for investment purposes. And that's not existed before.
I hope they don't physically hold it, because that would not be a good thing, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've got it. But you know, you have the, you know, the ETFs, you know, and other sort of instruments that again, you know, have grown up as a ways of, you know, adding value and making money in the uranium cycles that we haven't had in the past. So it does suck up a lot of the demand. So, you know, it's a really interesting sector to cover, a really interesting commodity, because as you said, you know, yourself, there's a huge amount of geopolitical inputs into it. But fundamentally, and as Jack's pointed out, you know, it's about the fuel mix. And I think to the extent that, you know, nuclear is now, I think, better understood as a key part of the fuel mix and is better accepted, you know, in government circles as a key part of the fuel mix. You know, that's really the structural underpinning for the bull market.
Yeah, I think many of the Western countries are talking about sort of mini projects in terms of the production of electricity or whatever through nuclear. So rather than these billions of dollars massive nuclear plants, to have smaller nuclear plants as well.
Well, Rolls-Royce are trying to develop the SMR, small modular reactor as well, which is could be a game changer.
Yeah, and also, you know, there's other uses for these reactors as well. They're not just power generation, but desalination is a big issue as well, particularly when you obviously think about the Middle East, and you know, that's nuclear is a key part of that. So I think, you know, it's going to continue, and we're very happy that we've got a very good position in it.
And I mean, in terms of, you say it's going to continue, I mean, I presume there is the current price an all-time high for uranium, or is the room still for it to run, or is there a
room for it to run? Yeah, it could go substantially higher. You know, I think mining companies, as a rule, I think, you know, you should sort of try and stay away a little bit from trying to, you know, predict commodity prices. You know, that's not really our area, you know, as it were. I mean, our job is to do what Jack's just done, which is to stake out high value properties, you know, and add value to them. But I do think that certainly all the things I read is that you could be talking about substantially higher price. So certainly a sustainable rise. There was a very good article on Bloomberg the other day, which Meryn Somerset Redd wrote about this, and she got some really good data on it. And I think this is just showing really what we've talked about, which are those structural underpinnings, but the fact that it's not like, you know, copper, where you can bring on, you know, more capacity quite easily. It's very difficult to bring on uranium capacity. It takes a long time. And so there isn't suddenly going to be a huge sort of supply response which is going to fill in all that demand. You know, it's the world is short of it and needs a lot of it.
Do you anticipate then that the same thing will happen, because most of these things are like pendulums? So at $30 a pound, nobody wants to mine this stuff. At $100 a pound, obviously it's very economic to mine it, and it goes up to $150 a pound possibly. Then there is an element of oversupply comes into the market, do you think? Or do you think that isn't really possible?
Well, I think ultimately, you know, that's the case in all markets, isn't it? You know, that at some point, either the market will go into oversupply, or, and obviously we obviously hope not, you know, there will be some sort of an event that, you know, that reduces demand. I mean, you know, absolutely, God forbid that there would be, but, you know, that has happened in the past. But at some point, all commodity markets come back into balance. But I think this one has got such strong fundamentals that there is a long way to go from here. Now, whether or not, you know, we hold these assets all the way through the cycle, or control them, I should say, all the way through the cycle, you know, that's the next question, really. And for us, you know, my job is to make money for our shareholders and to make the best returns that we possibly can on our asset set, but also to, you know, keep our capital moving and recycling. So, you know, I'm certainly not looking to sell my uranium assets at this particular point, but we do have to be conscious that we're not an asset manager, and we do have to actively manage the project so that, you know, we add that value we talked about through the early stage exploration, but that we also seek to monetize, you know, and whether or not that's going into a strategic JV with maybe a bigger operator, maybe it's, you know, securing the portfolio with perhaps royalties to give us the capital to explore. It's important to understand that uranium exploration is expensive. The holes are deep. The area we're talking about, you know, it's the, you know, the Park Lane or the Mayfair, if you like, of uranium, no question. But Jack will tell you, to get in there, you've got to go via helicopter. There's not a lot of infrastructure. Yeah, it's expensive stuff. So am I going to expect my shareholders to, you know, stump up for a big exploration program, you know, to a limited extent? But I think what we've got to look for is capital solutions with partners, which is what we do elsewhere in the portfolio, of course, to get that capital in, to get that exploration work done. So, and that will require marking some of this stuff to market, you know, at a price. And that's why the UEE IPO, which Jack's going to lead for us, is so important, because not only does it give investors the opportunity to get hold of Athabasca Basin focused uranium exploration, which is very rare, it's certainly not possible in the UK. You can obviously buy it in Canada, but first of all, you get that opportunity. Secondly, what it does is it will help value the balance of the portfolio. So, you know, if UEE is trading at a great price, which we believe and hope that it will, then when people come to us and say, right, we want to do a deal with you on this one, and this one, we can say, well, you know, the price to an extent is going to be set by UEE. Okay, you know, at the moment, people will say, well, we'll give you X for it, and then we'll give a spend requirement and so on. But the price perhaps looks a bit modest because they're putting it into a shell and they don't want to trigger a reverse or, you know, whatever structures we're talking about. UEE will say, well, this is the price. This is what the market believes these things are worth. So, you know, we're always looking. That's what our job is to find ways to add value for the shareholders, and that's why we're doing this partial spin out. So, you know, it's a really exciting opportunity. We're in the marketing mode now. I wish I could talk a little bit more detail about exactly the projects that are going in. They're still subject to some regulatory approvals and processes that will determine that, but we will very shortly be announcing the full asset set for UEE. And we'll be giving investors the opportunity to invest. And, you know, we're appointing a broker, and the marketing materials will all be published very soon. And we'll be able to talk directly about the exact timelines for that. But I would hope that we can achieve that by the end of March. I mean, we've said during March. I mean, I don't want to say specific date, but we want to get this deal done during March. And bar the, you know, just raising the money, we're pretty much there. So very confident this gets over the line. Jack's going to be the CEO and he's going to lead it for us, design the exploration program, you know, and deliver those results for us. And it's going to be a really, really exciting story. And we're very confident that it'll add a lot of value, both directly for investors who want to buy UEE, but for Power Metal shareholders as well.
And Jack, I'm assuming as CEO, you've said, I want this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one. And you,
well,
yeah, that we've had together, I think there's been an issue too.
Yeah,
it doesn't actually mean that you're right either. But I'm saying that you have had your pick of the most prospective ones, or you wish to have the pick of the most prospective.
Well, yes, I know that, you know, this, the whole portfolio is highly prospective, but you need to have one camp in the Power Metal Uranium still needs to actually have exciting projects to deliver shareholder value, but also so does UEE. So we don't want to cannibalize and strip out Power when it can still achieve great things with the current project assets.
Yes, I understand. So what sort of valuation is likely on UEE then? Are we talking similar to Golden Metal Resources, sort of, yeah, 8 million, 9 million, 10 million, something around there?
That's the ballpark given, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, one thing it's very fair to say, okay, is when you're talking about very early stage assets like this, it's extremely difficult to value them. You know, they don't have a resource. They obviously don't have, you know, pre-feasibility or anything of that order. So you're saying, I've got prospective ground now, very prospective ground, and we've done work on it, and we can talk about that, and we can say why we think it's so prospective. But at the end of the day, it's not an arbitrary figure, but you get a competent person's report, and you say, look, this is what we want to value it at, so that we can make the, you know, get onto the exchange, give it a decent amount of liquidity and size and so on. And you ask your competent person if they're happy to validate that, and you know, in this case, they are. But you know, it is difficult. So the market will ultimately decide. But I think what I would say is that we've been working on this for quite some time, and you know, we haven't revalued the assets that we're putting in for at least a year. Meanwhile, the sector's performed extremely well. So it's going to look, I think, you know, it's going to look good value. It's going to reflect the fact that it's early stage, of course, but it's also going to reflect the fact that a certain amount of work has been done over the properties, which Jack's led for us. And I think that investors are going to get a really good blend of different types of geology and different, you know, opportunities to, how do I put it, you know, sort of exploit the uranium trend, if I can put it that way. So, you know, there's going to be, can't say too much about which actual properties we're talking about yet, but, you know, you're going to get a nice blend of different geology. So, you know, a good...
I can tell Sean dying to tell us which ones they are.
Well, no, I am. Anyway. When we next speak, we'll be able to talk a lot more in detail. We certainly will. And there's a lot of other stuff we want to talk about with you. And as we said, you know, I think just before we came on, there's a lot of stuff happening at Power, as there always is. And there's a bunch of things that we want to talk more about Saudi Arabia and the opportunity there, and talk specifically about what we're going to try and do there. So I hope, you know, you'll have us back in a week or so.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Jack, I've got a question then. So here you go. You've got £2 to £3 million burning a hole in your pocket, and you're a geologist, so you like to put holes in the ground. So where and what are you going to put holes in the ground? And obviously you can't tell us exactly the projects, but the scenario is, what do you envisage you're going to spend that money on, you know? To, I mean, I see, and maybe I'm wrong, but I see Power Metals almost as a Lassonde curve play. Okay, we take a project and we move it up that curve and dispose of it and still party with part of it. So how do you envisage that will happen in the uranium? Because I presume to produce uranium, you're going to need tens of millions of dollars. It's not going to happen with $2 or $3 million. So how do you propose to generate growth in the value of these things with that money?
So firstly, each of the projects, you kind of need to think of them case-by-case basis. So taking Reichenbach, which is one of the assets that we're going to bring into UAE, and we've already announced, there hasn't been any significant... Well, we completed a geophysical survey there over the summer, and a radiometric survey. That's given us some areas we're interested in, but there hasn't been any actual solid field work done there since late 80s. And since then, time techniques have moved on an awful lot. The ability for us to actually identify different elements in the soils, different techniques. We used radon quite successfully on Tate Hill over the summer. I'd like to apply that to Reichenbach as well. So we're not going to be running towards a drill rig initially, purely because it's incredibly expensive to drill. And these kind of deposits, unlike a lot of the rest of our portfolio, we can do a lot of work to really refine in where the target is from geochemistry, from geophysics and such like, without needing to run towards a drill and spend a large amount of shareholder capital. So the intention is for this year likely to be more superficial work to really hone in an area you're interested in and then look towards drilling. So the initial 2 million is likely to be sent on that kind of work package. Obviously, it's going to be spread around more assets that we will discuss in the coming weeks and such like. But we have to be slow. I'd rather sort of measure 2 or 3 times and cut once rather than cut once. And if we don't make discoveries and such like that, that's not bringing a shareholder value. It's just literally putting money into the ground, which, although it's fun, you know, it's not good.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. I mean, basically, we're taking these assets up the Lassonde curve, and then hopefully there's going to be a queue of people that are lining up to JV or give you a serious amount of money so you can stick some holes in the ground, I presume, is the way forward.
Definitely. That's a nice summary, because that's what the Power Metal model is. You know, whether it's uranium, whether it's the nickel in Botswana, where we're drilling at the moment, you know, that's how we do things. So we do the yards at the beginning. But it's interesting you referenced the Lafon curve, because, you know, that bit, that initial part, we all know that's where all the excitement is for investors, but that's also where there's a lot of risk. That is what we do, and that's what we're sticking to. And you know, I think that the uranium portfolio is an extremely good example of how that curve works.
Yeah, the project incubator model, as I think I've seen on the slides.
Yes, exactly right.
But as you've said, really, that the uranium package that is within Power Metal, because I was doing some calculations myself earlier. With the 62% of GMET, I think you've got 23% of first class metals. And within 2 months, let's say, you're going to have a significant holding within the uranium package. So let's say it's the same as GMAT, 63% or 62%. So those alone would be worth 14 million pounds, and your market cap is 20 million today. You've still got gold assets. You're still going to have uranium packages yourself. You're moving forward and have raised money with the Saudi acquisition. I named just a few because you've also just said you're drilling for nickel in Botswana, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is so many catalysts within Power Metal that should mean you're more highly valued than you are at the minute. I mean, you've obviously had a nice ride because you were at 0.5, which was ridiculous, up to a penny. And you've raised money above the price, because ultimately the price was 0.9, I think, when you raised a penny. So, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the market actually realizing that there is value here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad you referenced raise. Actually, it was quite a lot lower when we agreed to do it at a penny. It was, you know, we were sort of 0.7, I think, or thereabouts. So it was a real validation of the model that the investors that we brought in were happy to pay such a big premium. And I think people have seen, you know, the Pure Bond, who backed Kavango so heavily, one of our major shareholders. In fact, they're our biggest individual shareholders. So, you know, that's fantastic. We've got Rick Rule also, who's a very large shareholder. And he brings a lot of credibility, obviously, from his background, but through his network as well. Just a couple of things. I mean, I think the holding we have in UE probably be a little bit lower than we have with Golden Metal, but still very substantial. So we'll be able to talk a bit more about that as we get the marketing material out. But the other thing I should also mention is First Development Resources, where we're also undertaking an IPO at the moment. Now, that's been tricky. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, Australia has been a very, very difficult market to raise capital in, our Australian assets. But we are making great progress there, and that is well underway. So we are hoping to be able to update more on that in the coming, well, days certainly, but, you know, weeks at the maximum. And Tristan Potters, who runs that for us, is as positive as he's ever been on his asset set. He's ready to drill. He's got a grant from the Western Australian government, and he, you know, well, as soon as he's got his money, he's underway. So that could add value extremely quickly to the business. Again, we'll be a substantial shareholder of that, but nothing adds value like a drill campaign. And, you know, Tristan is absolutely ready to go. And of course, investors who, you know, who made a lot of money, I'm sure, in Greatland Gold, you know, in FDR, they're looking at something potentially, you know, very similar. It's, you know, it's a Javier on style deposit, and it's a magnetic bullseye anomaly, very analogous to Greatland Gold. Now, obviously, one can get too carried away, you know, you haven't drilled it yet, but people who, you know, in the previous sort of bull phase backed Greatland, made a lot of money, you know, you're looking at something very, very similar. So I would say to investors, we're excited about the uranium, we're excited about the nickel in Botswana, but we're also very excited about the prospects we've got through FDR in Australia. And there is, again, you know, a process going on with appointing brokers and getting the marketing really underway. So if people are interested in that one, you know, we're obviously, you know, very keen to assist and to help people get invested. So that's going to generate a lot of news and a lot of value for us. But these Saudi projects, again, are going to be the next leg. Saudi and Oman, I should say, where, you know, this is a very, very underexplored territory. You've got a great setup with, you know, a government who really wants it to work, a lot of investors who want to put money in, a lot of people who have licenses where maybe they are not as active as they should be and they're facing the prospect they might lose them, where we can go in and partner with them and do what we do at that early stage value, that Lafon curve that you talked about. And then obviously, again, as we have in other cases, seek to monetize that. Now, we're looking at the right capital structure for the Saudi assets, and it may be that we can set up a standalone UEE, FDR, GMET, whatever, that covers all of the Saudi Arabian and Omani opportunities. So again, we'll give investors that opportunity to invest directly in that. And that's very attractive to the local investors, to the investors in the region. You know, they want to invest in their own area, but they love our model and through which to do it. And that's how we brought some Saudis in. So we're looking at that. And again, it's going to generate, I think, a lot of value. So You're very experienced at this, Kevin. You know that we say to CEOs, you know, you shouldn't really talk about your share price. You should get on with running the business and the market will take care of that. You know, but in the AIM market, you've got to be conscious that you've got to drive returns. You've got to do the things that are going to attract investors. And I hope that we are doing that. And I do think that, we're in a position to make people some money.
I think the interesting thing with Power Metal, until the last 12 months, and we've obviously been with Oliver Friesen at the Golden Metal Resources now for close on a year, since it listed on my birthday, which was the 10th of May last year, as I keep reminding him every time we interview, there's going to be a much easier way of valuing Power Metal Resources on a basic level. Because, I mean, you talked about four or five babies, basically, that you're going to have. You're going to have GMET, you're going to have FDR, maybe you have a Saudi situation, you have the uranium situation, So even those, I think there's four is the
and there's new Ballarat as well, an ion battery as well, I think, from memory.
That's right. And we've got a stake in New Horizon Metals and obviously a stake in First Class.
We're going to need a longer podcast to go through the whole of these presentations. We're going to the 2-hour show, I think, don't we, to cover the whole lot.
And I think this is the point, Sean, is that in some way, I think people have missed the point because there is so much going on in Power Metal Resources, and therefore the value has corresponded because there's so much. Mm. But I think what's going to happen with these separate stakes going out, it's going to be a very easy valuation model with adding then what's left in Power Metal, which is still very valuable, regardless of the stakes in each one of these things. So, I mean, we've been talking with Charles and we looked at the note that he wrote.
Yes.
You've got 3.3p and he thinks that's going to go up because more and more things are coming out. I mean, even just to look at Golden Metal Resources, the steps forward there that they've made at Garfield and steps forward that they've made with the project with Tungsten now that they've found the Alf Garnet. They found garnets at a ridiculous level of 40%, That is a phenomenal amount of dollars that could be added to the overall and also cause less processing required because you're taking those out in the first place. So I think hopefully people are going to see as time goes by, and for sure we'll have you back on over the next number of weeks to talk about the different parts. But I think I just want to say to people, look at the sum of the parts, because the sum of the parts is far, far greater than the current market capitalization of Power Metal Resources, without a shadow of a doubt. And as Charles Archer said in his investment note, 3.3p is the target. And I think he's being slightly conservative there with a lot of the things. It's not beyond the bounds possibility the uranium projects come out at 8 million and suddenly are going to be worth 16 million. It's not beyond the bounds if GMET gets some sort of grant from the American government that it's going to double its value at least, because all of a sudden they're drilling for free. So there are many, many catalysts. And I think if you want an overall general investment that is going to cover so many different projects and so many different territories, so many different asset classes, this is one to look at.
Yeah, well, that's a great summary, Kevin, and absolutely, the message we're giving, and we talk about, the different stakes that we have and everything. It's very important that we're not a passive asset manager. We are a very active explorer, and fundamentally at heart, we're an explorer. I mean, yes, we talk about the merchant banking model as Rick Rule has helpfully described it, and that does talk about how we think about managing the capital and how we allocate the capital to the project. But fundamentally, it's the drivers of this business, the drivers of the value are Jack and his team, who actually do the exploration work, and deliver those exciting results. And we hope that Monopo is going to do that. We're drilling in there at the moment. I mean, with the update from the site is that we're now well over 200 meters of depth, and with no problems so far. I mean, I was out there last week. We did a little video from there, and it's a great project. We've got the best target I think we've had. We're very excited about the opportunity there, and hopefully in a week or so we'll get to 500 plus meters, and we'll start seeing some mineralization. And of course, what we can report, we will report. And the actual confirmation, the assay testing, will obviously take longer. But we are hoping that we can get something into the attention of investors very soon to say what we're looking at there. So again, there's a big short-term catalyst there.
And the other interesting thing that I think, and I've had many comments from investors, is that Oliver Friesen, CEO, but he's a geologist. And Jack, you're in the same scenario. You're a geologist. Is this the start of a new market scenario where we put someone who knows what they're talking about in terms of the actual project in charge of the actual project, yeah, and not just a figurehead as a CEO. Because to me, it seems to make ultimate sense, as long as they've obviously got some financial acumen as well. And they have the backing, obviously, of all the other people at power, because ultimately, you know, you're not on your own, if you like. There is, I presume, groups that you're meeting with all the time. So it's a very interesting model, even from that perspective. I mean, I think you mentioned Tristan. Is Tristan a geologist as well?
Oh, yeah, very much so. So, you know, I go out with these guys and they're educating me. They're doing a fantastic job. I'm, you know, I think they say that I now probably know just about enough to be dangerous. But, you know, you know, I stay in my lane. You know, I don't call them up if that's a geo at all. I mean, I'm a finance guy and my job is the business, all the investor relations stuff, the representing the company, stuff,
yeah,
have you. But with the subsidiaries, the spin-out companies, they're run by the geos who know what they're doing and they know what they're looking for and they know how to find it. And then that's what Jack's going to deliver for us at UEE.
Yeah, and I think I'm the same. I maybe not the same, even worse. I probably know less than you, so therefore I am dangerous. Possibly.
You're just dangerous anyway, Kev, to be honest.
So I will just ask the questions. But let's let Jack finish it off then. Jack, give us your 1 or 2 minute pitch on why somebody would want to invest in the UEE IPO. Why would we want to give our money to you and these prospective licenses?
Well, we've got some absolutely stellar projects. As Sean mentioned, we've got two. We have further ones to mention and discuss in the future. But we have two currently in the portfolio. We've done a small amount of exploration on them, and what we've seen is really encouraging. We are working in one of the hotspots of uranium exploration on Earth. I say this as someone who literally has masters in the area and tend to know what I'm talking about in some ways. We're also the only real pure play company on the AIM that's actively doing early stage exploration, so you're at the bottom of that curve to really get a value generated for shareholders. And ultimately, we've also got the backing of power. We don't talk about it very much in power in terms of what it is possible to do with these IPOs, having a back staff team that can quickly deal with things. But from the last couple of weeks as I've been taking on this role, it's really shown to me how important it is to have this corporate backing that can just swing in there, pretty much solve your problem without having to go to an exterior organization and such like. So we can be quick, we can be dynamic, and we can just be effective with the exploration that myself and the team will propose and plan.
Excellent. I think the time is now, and if we have an upswing in the market, I think, you know, power as itself is probably going to be worth £100 million, not £20 million, if we get the true valuations come out of these projects and you move them up the Lassonde curve. And I say that because I think Golden Metal Resources on its own has got a very good chance of being worth a huge amount of money based on the tungsten. The uranium, the same. You're waxing lyrical about FDR as well. And I have absolutely no doubt that there is great opportunity in the Saudi acquisitions as well, and that will undoubtedly come in terms of what you're trying to progress. So maybe that's a few years away, but ultimately the value will shine through as we move up in this cycle, because these plays in terms of resources cannot stay this lowly valued. It's not possible.
Okay. No, and I think, you know, I think capital is coming back into the sector. It's been a tough couple of years. We all know that. There was probably a bit too much capital that came in during the COVID period, and it chased a lot of things up. And, you know, I think we're getting back to more sort of sustainable, sensible capital markets, and that's good for us. You know, it's good for liquidity, and I think if we can carry on delivering, I'm sure that we can deliver, you know, a lot of value for shareholders.
Very good. So on that note, we'll say Jack Dann and Sean Wade of Power Metal Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Good luck, Jack.
Thank you very much. Look forward to it.
So let's have a look at some of the other movers and shakers this week. First one that springs to mind is, while we're on the subject of Power Metal and Golden Metal Resources, was GMET. Golden Metal Resources believes there is compelling evidence of lithium mineralization at their Nevada properties. The company reviewed historical data on the Kibby North and Kibby South lithium brine properties in Nevada and found that nearby drilling by a third party intersected strong lithium mineralization in brines and clays above the main geophysical conductive brine aquifer target for the entire Kibby Basin. With the main target still untested by drilling, Golden Metal is now assessing options to determine the optimal way to advance exploration on its properties. And Oliver sent a voice clip over, didn't he, towards the end of the week, and this is what he had to say.
Hey everyone, this is Oliver Friesen, the CEO of Golden Metal Resources. just providing a quick note and detailed overview of the RNS we put out covering our QB Basin lithium properties. The main takeaway from the RNS that we put out on Friday, February the 16th, was the fact that after doing further due diligence and technical overview of the available data sets, it was determined that the main conductor within the QB Lithium Basin, which extends onto our property, was determined to never be completely and adequately tested by drilling that was done in 2022 by a neighboring company. The reason that we believe this to be significant is the fact that a hole, a drill hole from 2022, KB2202, which was drilled 250 meters from our claim boundary, actually intersected two very intriguing zones. One was a lithium and clay intercept, which extended over about 160 meters, and another intercept, which showed very high enrichment of lithium in brines. However, both of these intersections, these exciting intersections, are now determined to lie stratigraphically above the main conductor, which is still at depth and untested. Why we're excited about this is the intersections made in KB2202, we believe, first of all, confirm the fact that this basin is lithium rich and lithium bearing, but more importantly, the fact that there's very thick intervals of lithium and clay mineralization, we believe, points to and gives us further encouragement about the conductor that is at depth, which has never been tested, because what happens geologically within these basins is you get a lot of waters, rain waters, groundwaters that will circulate through the sedimentary strata. And what can happen is they become enriched in whatever mineral or rock that these waters are percolating through. So if we're seeing very, very thick intervals of very enriched lithium within clays, what we believe is happening here or could have happened is a lot of the water circulated through these lithium clay intervals became enriched in lithium themselves, forming lithium brines. And once again, it's the main target at depth there, the very, very strong conductor, which we now can confirm has never been tested by drilling. So that's the main target now on the property, a very intriguing one. And as mentioned, the work that's been done to date, including the 2022 drilling, gives us a lot of confidence in what that target could be below, which, as I mentioned, has never been tested. So very, very exciting development on this property. It gives us a very intriguing target to go after. And I will leave it at that. I will be putting out a technical video as well. So please check our Twitter, Golden Metal Resources, to have a look at that video, which will provide a much more detailed analysis about this RNS. Thanks, everyone. Signing off. For further information, visit our Twitter, as I mentioned, or go to our website, goldenmetalresources.com.
The other one that had a good RNS on the 16th on Friday was African Pioneer. They announced the exercise of option and extension of the earning period under the option agreement. If you remember that First Quantum exercised their option agreement on two of the previous assets, didn't they, or licenses, and then they announced on Friday that they've exercised, that First Quantum have exercised their option over the remaining two licenses. So they have now exercised their complete four licenses subject of the option agreement. Basically, it stated that First Quantum has to prepare a technical report demonstrating an indicated mineral resource of at least 300,000 tons of contained copper to earn a 51% shareholding in African Pioneer Zambia. And that has been extended to 28th of February, 2026. So what do you make of that? The fact that now First Quantum have gone for the other two licenses and now they've exercised the option on the complete four licenses.
Yeah, I think it means there's copper there, doesn't it, really? Almost certainly. Based on their geological studies and stuff, they think it's a continuation of what's coming from the DRC. Is that 300,000 tons of contained copper on each license?
So the earning period in relation to the excise licenses was extended to the 28th of Feb. And basically, in order for First Quantum to earn that 51% interest in African Pioneer Zambia, has to prepare and fund a technical report demonstrating an indicated mineral resource of at least 300,000 tons of contained copper over the licenses subject to the option agreement. So it's over the whole of the four licenses.
Yeah, so 300,000 tons, let's say it's a 20-year mine life in all of those situations. That's 15,000 tons per annum as an absolute minimum to get them 51%. So 15,000 tons at 8,500 or let's say 8,000 ton per ton of the copper, you know, you do the maths, that's a lot. And then they do half of that African Pioneer. And African Pioneer has a market capitalization of £4 million. Like, you know, come on, guys, let's do the maths. Okay, so I mean, the reality is they haven't found it yet. They haven't said yes, it's definitely there, but they're saying that, you know, they have to take it to this level, which will cost them millions to take it to this point. And African Pioneer will then still be 49% shareholders in that situation, with potential to receive literally tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Yeah. And we have a market capitalization of 4 to 5 million. Yeah. So, I mean, I've been bashing on about this for a year and a half now, or longer probably, but yeah, you know, African Pioneer for me is one of the picks of 2024. I don't see how it's not worth significantly more than it is now. Yeah, and we're also here talking to you from Namibia, because we're about to visit two different projects, one from Bazant and one from African Pioneer. So we've got Hope and Garup for Bazant and Ongombo for African Pioneer, which is copper and gold with credits at least 1% copper. And I think it has a 23 million ton resource already created. And I think that should be expanded as time goes by. So, you know, how this is worth for the £5 million, I've absolutely no idea. In just the same way as we've just spoken to Sean in Power Metal, and you've heard all the different optionalities they have in the different projects, the different resources, and it is only worth £20 million. It's, yeah. I mean, if there isn't value in this resource sector, something is drastically wrong.
Yeah, I agree. I think so. We're going to go down and see Ongombo towards the end of the week, as well as the other projects you just alluded to within Bazant as well. So it'd be interesting. But they had an announcement, didn't they? Sort of, I think it's over a week ago now, that they basically notified that one of the licenses, EPL 5772, had been renewed for 2 years, and with the exact expiry date to be confirmed once stamped off. Done the environmental and social impact assessment, the ESIA, is at an advanced stage of completion, and XRT ore sorting sensor tests return positive results. So a good update on that project. And as you say, you've got that project there in Namibia. You've got the ones we just alluded to with First Quantum in Zambia. And then you've also got the Botswana Kalahari Copperbelt project with Sandfire Resources, and with Sandfire having a significant holding. And obviously First Quantum, you know, within the actual African Pioneer as significant shareholders. So crazy valuation at 5 million, but that's the market we're in at the moment, isn't it?
It is. But I mean, I think you just got to say be patient, because it will come. It has to come. You know, the valuation is there.
So one of the best movers of the week was Tech Capital, TEK, market cap of 27.6 million. They had basically announced that their portfolio company, Guidant, there's a leading autonomous vehicle teleoperation monitoring company, announced progress in its strategic partnership with AlvTech to integrate guidance remote monitoring passenger support services into AlvTech's Mika autonomous shuttle. For each Mika shuttle outfitted with guidance technology, Guidant will receive a hardware fee and a recurring license fee. And then we also saw Microsoft, who came to market, announced a collaboration with American Trading International, ATI, who are a leading US food and beverage export company. Being part of ATI's portfolio gives Microsoft the potential to make its low sodium products available in up to 80 countries worldwide, while facilitating achievable order minimums. ATI's presence at major international food trade shows will also enable Microsoft to reach new customers without the marketing expenses of attending shows. So that one was fairly well. Anything else on the radar that we've seen this week sort of move market? Helium One continues to go again, doesn't it?
Went up, went down, went up, went down. I think at one point it went to 1.6 or 1.5p. Like went down to that price when it hit 3p on Monday, I think it was, and then it's come back again towards the end of the week, I think.
2.5, 2.4 finish, yeah.
Yeah, just as a knowledge, if you want to read some notes, Charles Archer did actually do one on Tech Capital. That's one of his favorites, I think. And also this week he published a note on Golden Metal Resources, which I thought was very, very good. It just given an absolute overview of what Golden Metal Resources is all about. And again, even having started at 8.5p and moved up to, I think, around the 14 to 15p mark, still huge value in that. I mean, if some of those things come off, it's going to be worth significantly more than that. So again, very good read if you want to, if you enjoy reading rather than listening. And again, there is a Power Metals note that Charles Archer also wrote a good while ago now. He wrote it, I think, in the middle of last year, but it's worth a read. I think we can maybe spread it in the groups. Again, people can have a read of it if you want to read it, just to give you a general overview of what Power Metal is all about, because it's a bit complicated. There's a lot of things going on there. It's not just one or two projects. So yeah,
good.
Other than that, we're looking forward to seeing these projects in Namibia, seeing a bit of wildlife, seeing the Skeleton Coast, hopefully, which will be both scary and very exciting all at the same time. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, we'll give some reports.
So, there was one movie I watched this week, and I just want to get this in because this was fantastic. One of those, sometimes you watch a movie and it's just one of those inspirational things. Basically, it's called Naiad, based on a true story. Remarkable true story of the athlete Diana Naiad, who at the age of 60, with the help of a best friend and coach, commits to achieving this lifelong ambition, the first person ever to swim from Cuba to Florida. And she tried it when she was 30 and failed, but that you've got to watch the movie on Netflix. It's Oscar nomination stuff. Performance, Jodie Foster's in it and Annette Bening, and it's just one of the best movies I've seen in a long, long time. So that's Naiad, 2023 Oscar nomination, and watch it this weekend and you'll absolutely love it.
Very good.
So on that note, thanks for listening. And if you like what you've heard, hit the subscribe icon and the bell icon for any future notifications of further episodes.
Yeah, you can get us on all the different podcast places that you get your podcasts, and also go to YouTube. And if you've got any stocks that you want to, you know, go back to and think, oh, what was said in the past and what was that all about? All of the podcasts are on YouTube. All of the podcasts are on Audio Booms now. I think 360 or 370 different podcasts on various different companies. So, you know, if you want to go back and do a bit of research on those and say that was wrong or that was right or whatever, it can be useful for you. So it's a library there for everybody to use. And one of the reasons why the companies want us to do this, so that the stuff is there and they can, you know, people can go back and look at what has happened in the past.
Good. Thanks for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.